future we were promised.
Hi, Jinx and Sue Podcast, episode 71. I'm your host, Joel Watson, from the online comic Hi, Jinx and Sue at hijinxandsue.com. This is a different episode. Instead of your typical three-person Joel, Eli, Josh geek discussion of geek pop culture, this is going to be a one-on-one interview with myself and Chris Hardwick, the Nerdist, from Nerdist.com and the Nerdist Podcast. This was recorded at the Addison Improv Comedy Club in Addison, Texas, while Chris was doing a stand-up stint last weekend. So please enjoy. If this is your first Hi, Jinx and Sue podcast, please feel free to peruse the archive. There's literally hundreds of hours of podcasting non-sensory for you to enjoy. And if you are not listening to the Nerdist podcast, please fill your ear holes with that nerdery. It's good stuff with lots of famous geeks and nerds being interviewed, and you are sure to enjoy it. So please enjoy this interview with Chris Hardwick, and Godspeed, you fancy bastards. Hi, Jinx and Sue Podcast, here with Chris Hardwick, the Nerdist, nerd raconteur, podcaster, comedian. Are you a professional Nerdist? Is that like a title that was bestowed upon you, or
I don't...
your doctorate?
It's an honorary title. I'm an honorary Nerdist.
You gave a commencement speech at Nerd College, and
that's right.
They give you a nerd doctorate.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't actually have to do any of the work.
At least you got something to frame.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's all. That's all that matters. And of course, I will. You know, I will force people to use that,
Dr. Hardwick,
as a salutation,
Reverend Dr. Hardwick.
Reverend Dr. Hardwick.
I apologize.
I was actually filling out something recently, and it allowed you to pick the salutation. And the first one, I was like, why wouldn't I pick this? It was Admiral. So I was Admiral.
Well,
Chris Hardwick.
A nerdism degree is an admiral.
I guess
that's
so.
That's the delegation.
Why wouldn't I want to be an admiral?
It's a naval degree. So I want to jump right into it. And a couple of questions that I've had for you. I've listened to your podcast. I think I understand the Nerdist philosophy and sort of what you're doing with your brand of you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's kind of the first thing. It seems like the way things work now, you can't be labeled anymore, and the thing that you're selling is yourself. It's sort of a cult of a person. It's an individual that you're putting out. Chris Hardwick, podcaster, comedian, television personality in multiple venues. Is that all one thing, or is there one thing you would rather focus on?
I think they're all facets, you know, like they're all satisfying in different ways. And I think they all sort of fit together to form one, to form what it is that ultimately that is my full-time thing. So my full-time thing is comprised of a lot of part-time things.
Do you feel
all
like
of which I enjoy?
Do you feel like that's new? That wasn't possible 5 years ago? That you were trying to be? You know, you were on TV 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Did you feel like there was one path to quote unquote stardom?
I don't know if that's because that's how it was, or if people just didn't think to do that yet. I mean, when you think about in the 80s, before the 90s, in the 80s and before, like, there were TV people and there were movie people. Like, it was a big deal that Michael J. Fox made the jump to film.
Yeah. And it screwed up a couple of his films and shows. Like, there were wars over his time when he was trying to make that jump.
Right. So it's... You really kind of just, you know, like, people had very compartmentalized thinking. I mean, even just look at radio before. It was just like, this station is all classic rock.
Yeah.
This station is all this, you know. And now there are these, you know, like, Jack FM, these stations that just program, like, playlists.
They're just glorified MP3 players.
Essentially they are. And so, you know, I would say maybe 10 or 15 years ago, it wouldn't have occurred to me because just the internet being in its kind of nascent consumer stage, that there wasn't, the niche thing, we weren't really a niche culture yet. I mean, the internet sort of allowed, or the web really allowed us to become a niche culture.
If one of these things sticks, is there one that you would prefer?
Well, I mean, you know, stand-up is, I mean, I always think of myself as a stand-up first, but you know, you can't, in order to be a stand-up, people have to show up to your shows, and right. in order for that to happen, then you have to do things that are very public so that, you know, the people that might like you will come out to see your shows. And so it's
when did you start to notice that snake sort of eating its own head? Like, did you maybe after the podcast started, did you see more podcast people coming to the shows? Or
the podcast, it's so funny because I think by and large, to the general populace, podcasts don't necessarily get any kind of respect as an actual medium. And I think they're the most powerful forms of media because they... Thank you. Because more people... Joel just handed me a water, in case you were wondering.
Mm-hmm.
More people now reference the podcast when they come out to shows than anything else. Like, everything else put together. It's the podcast.
Are they coming out making specific references to single episodes? And
they do, or people, you know, people say, hey, I came out because I listened to the podcast way more than I came out because I watched G4 or, you know, or any of the TV stuff.
Is that the payment for the podcast? Because right now, everyone that's doing a podcast, even the top 10 comedy podcasts, including yourself, seem like they're still trying to figure out how that's a business model.
Well, yeah, that was always the original business model for me, and that's why I never intended to charge for it, because I just wanted as many people to hear it as possible so that it might help. I mean, you know, there's part of my doing the podcast that was me wanting to sort of take control of a part of my career and do something that I owned and was responsible for that no one could mess with. And then the other part of it was, and hopefully it'll drive people out to shows. So that was its original business model.
It seems to be working that way.
And that seems to be working. I mean, I don't have any intention to ever start charging for shows. I mean, unless we were to do like, oh, this is a very special 2-hour right. live show with musical. I mean, like even the Largo shows that we did that were, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours long. I haven't charged for those yet, but at a certain point, I might have to, because it requires a crew and preparation, and I'd like to be able to pay guests like it's a talk show. And it just, you know, like I've said to people before, it does cost money to give away free things.
Yeah. That's my job. I mean, that's what I do. I create content, give it away, and then hope that you'll decide to pay for something later that you probably already had for free. So that's one of the things I find so interesting about what you're doing, is that you're doing something that a lot of us online cartoonists are doing, but in a different venue and in a much larger, sort of grander venue. Whereas we make, you know, 3, 4, 5 comics a week, give them to everybody. There's a certain percentage that'll never pay for anything. Mm-hmm. And then there's a certain percentage that enjoy what you do enough to buy a shirt, buy a book. Are you trying to cultivate that in your audience where you know you're giving away the podcast, you're giving away hours and hours and hours of entertainment so that you can sell other entertainment? Or...
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily expect that from people, but I mean, I hope that, I mean, if I put something out, like I'm writing a book that'll be out hopefully next fall, and if that happens, I hope people will buy it. But that, I mean, and it's not for the reason of, I want to make millions of dollars off these masses of people. Lemmings, they'll give up money for anything. It's more just so that I can continue to make stuff.
Right.
And, you know, put more stuff out there.
In the realm of the things that you are making, we mentioned you are on legitimate television, but then you were also on the less legitimate internet, for lack of a better, you know, lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, you know, that podcasts don't get a lot of respect.
I mean, they do in podcast circles. They
sure.
do. I mean, like,
when
you're
sitting on a couch with Scott Aukerman and Mark Maron,
sure,
you might have something to talk about. But I mean, like, do you feel like you have this? Is there a creative and artistic freedom in podcasting that you're more punching a clock on TV, and then in stand up and podcasting, you are free to do what you want to do?
Well, I mean, I feel like I pretty much only take TV jobs now that I feel like I will have fun doing. So I don't have any TV jobs where it feels like, ugh, I gotta go do this to pay the bills.
Well,
like,
sure.
But of course, there's much more freedom on the podcast because I am the boss of it,
right?
And I can say whatever I want.
As much as there is one.
Sure, exactly. And you know, and at the same time, I'm responsible for it if it sucks. Like, it's my fault. So that's an interesting. I weirdly like that about it, that it's all my responsibility. I take 100% responsibility for the podcast.
Do you ever get any kind of feedback that makes you feel like it sucks? I mean, do you internalize anything like that? Like, I know with TV, it's like the masses shouting at nothing
And then occasionally something sticks and, you know, maybe like a rogue Twitter comment or something. But you're not necessarily responsible for, let's say you do Chelsea, you're not responsible for that. Does any criticism towards the podcast hit you harder because it is sort of all on you?
Well, I think criticism in any form is hard if you, you know, if you're putting a lot of stuff into the world, because you're, you know, you to a degree, you're putting yourself out there. I mean, even though, you know, the content on Chelsea might not be, you know, material that is I'm pulling out of my soul. I mean, I really wouldn't. I wouldn't call what I do
zing
on Chelsea
Paris
artistic. I wouldn't call my, you know, my making fun of celebrities on Chelsea artistic in any way. But it's still something that I do, and I still, you know, put time into it. And
yeah.
But yeah, as far as the podcast, I mean, I assume like anything you do, there's going to be a percentage of people that think you're the worst person ever, and a percentage of people that think you're great, and then most people are just probably okay with you,
right? And then those people never talk to you.
And those people never talk. Yeah. I mean, if I get
at Nerdist, I'm super just okay with everything you do.
This is like when Steve Martin introduced Ben Stiller at the Oscars that year. You loved him in this movie. You loved him in this movie, and you were fine with him in Mystery Men,
right?
But
keep it up or don't.
Right.
I'm happy.
So if I get an email that says, you know, like in the beginning, we all were sort of figuring out the format a little bit, and we would talk over each other a lot. And so I would get emails and be like, why do you have to fucking interrupt each other? This is another one. Someone said, why do you talk about yourself on the podcast? Like, why are you trying to make it about you? And an email like that is irritating, but I will take the time to respond to it because it's legitimate.
Right.
It's a legitimate complaint, and so I will say, well, because I want the podcast to be conversational, and if you're having a conversation with someone, that's how you relate
to
people.
You do.
Someone tells you something they do, and you go, oh, well, that's funny. I do this or this or this. You're just relating to them, because it's very difficult to interrogate someone for an hour.
Stop talking. Hang on.
Right.
Your story is dumb. Yeah. Your story is stupid. Here's my thing.
Here's how it really works. But, you know, someone's like that, I will take the time to explain, like, here's why I do what you're saying, and you know, and then at that point, I feel like, well, you can like it or not. And, you know, that's. But if someone says, like, you're a piece of shit, and I hope you get hit by a meteor, then I guess those bum me out just for the reason of, like, why would you ever think it's okay to talk to another person that way? I mean, I personalize it in such a way where, I mean, I imagine, like, you walk up to someone in a room and say, like, you're a piece of shit, and I hope you get hit by a meteor. Like, you would never do
that
to someone.
And that doesn't even feel good in this context.
No,
like, just hearing those words out of another person's mouth, even in jest, doesn't feel great.
I mean, I feel bad, like, for humanity when that happens. Like, what? Like, are we really at a place where it's okay to just, you know, say the worst things you can think of?
There's a whole generation of kids with this cloak of anonymity.
Sure.
And a lot of... you're more exposed now than you ever were.
Of course, you
could never have reached out to someone on television or even on the radio or whatever and even expected a response. And now you can sort of almost always at least expect one.
Instantaneously. Yeah. It takes almost no effort. And
I tweeted Chris Hardwick 8 hours ago. What is he doing?
So that blows me out for that reason, because I like being nice to people, and I never think it's okay, but, you know, it's whatever. It is what it is. And I guess part of it, I mean, if you want to spin it in a positive way, I guess it's, well, you know, the more you put yourself out there, the more of that, you know, you're going to get. And the truth is, it's, and you probably know this because you put your stuff out there. It's a very small percentage of the overall, it's a very small percentage of the overall feedback.
We talked a bit about Twitter, and you're obviously in that sort of upper Twitter echelon your thoughts about farts go out to millions of people. And
it's very satisfying.
Is it satisfying? Is it incredibly weird? Is it? Can you not think about it?
I don't think about it most of the time. I mean, I don't feel like I write anything differently than I would write if I, you know, had 100 people following me. Like, I don't really.
One thing that really interests me about Twitter, and I feel like I've seen this happen for you, but I want to know if you feel this way. On a recent podcast, Doug Benson mentioned that Twitter is the secret, sort of the Oprah secret. That if you,
I wonder,
like,
if I was, I think that sounds familiar. I might have been on that.
If
podcast.
You if you tweet something, it's more likely to come to fruition than if it's not. And how in has there been a circumstance, or in what ways has Twitter fulfilled any lifelong dreams for you, or made connections that you
absolutely
never
I've made friends with so many people that I respect through Twitter, and friendships have been strengthened through Twitter. Yeah. I mean, there are people that I didn't know before that I became friends with on Twitter, that, you know, just people that I would, that I respect, that I would send out a tweet like, hey, you're awesome, and they'd be like, hey, thanks, and then, you know, the next thing you know, we're following each other and then we're pals.
Anybody in particular that blows your mind that you never would have thought?
Well, actually, we're not pals, but Kevin Spacey tweeted back at me once. I'm sure he has no idea who I am, but for whatever reason, like, it's still, I still got that charge of like, oh my God, Kevin Spacey tweeted at me, you know?
Well, like, Weird Al comes to mind for me. I don't know. I don't think you met him on Twitter, but it's sort of that, that sort of childhood, like, I'm 8 years old. Never in a billion years will I be friends with Weird Al. I'll keep listening to even worse.
You right, know? Right.
Did it take you a while to get over that, or do you kind of come to a point where it's sort of a, you know, equalization where people are just people? And
I mean, I'm pretty good friends with Al, and I still can't wrap my mind around it sometimes, because we just did a music festival. There was a comedy night of a music festival in Austin called Fun 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 Fest, and I went on right before Al, and then Al headlined the show. And before the show, he was like, "So, do you want to come out and sing a line from Yoda?" And I was like, "Sure." And then I did it, and then it sank in. I was like, "Oh my God!" Like, first of all, he did his full show, like 2 hours, and it was incredible. I haven't seen him perform in probably 5 or 6 years. And the show was incredible.
Yeah.
And then
he never gives less than 100%.
No,
never.
And then to come out and be a part of it was so mind-blowing, because I'm still, I like you said, I'm still that kid that had in 3D or
yeah.
And so it freaks me, you know, like I have internal freakouts about it. But
I kind of went through the same. To make this about me.
Please.
Please stop talking. I sort of the same thing happened to me earlier this year when I started talking to Will Wheaton online, who I know is a good friend of yours.
Yeah.
And we've met a few times, and we're working on some projects together and various things. And it's like, it'll never, it's always in the back of my head that he flies that fucking Starship. That will never change for me, regardless of how many normal conversations we have.
Right.
Or email, you know, back and forth trying to one up each other on, you know, that's my cover band jokes. It never leaves my mind that, but he flew that fucking Starship. And, oh man. Like I was 10 when he was flying that Starship.
Yeah.
It's freaking me the fuck out. And, I feel like Twitter is kind of, or at least the internet in general, is that great equalizer where you realize that everybody, as long as they're cool, everybody is a fan of something. And
they really are. It really, I mean, because, you know, if people tweet regularly, with few exceptions, you really get a sense of who they are. Like, some people just tweet, like, absurd jokes every time.
Or promotional stuff.
Or promotional stuff. Which I think if you're just going to tweet promotional stuff, it's a waste of time.
Yeah.
Like, Alyssa Milano was someone I became friends with on Twitter. And I don't know how, but, like, one day I realized, like, I think Alyssa Milano's following me, and I don't know why she started following me. And then I followed her back, and, you know, we exchanged some DMs, and she was incredibly sweet. And she really is she has very geeky interests.
There's things that can happen on Twitter that the one party, like the unaware party, will find more monumental than the aware party, I guess. Like I made a comic about Toy Story 3 and retweet the director of Toy Story 3 posts a link to it, and I'm like, well, that doesn't make sense, you know. There's nothing about that's possible. And Alyssa Milano retweeted a comic I did one time. I can't remember what it was about, but it's like, again, it's not a world that I live in. I'm really far from LA, and but the internet, you know,
Like, it's localizing.
Yeah,
it's very localizing.
Celebrities in my
it doesn't matter.
Life,
it's very
know?
It's very localizing. But what I've learned is that it's I've learned that there is a little bit of responsibility if you know that you know a lot of people are listening, and it's kind of fun sometimes to you know like there's this show on FX called Terriers that I really like.
Yeah, I listened to your show about that
with Donal. Yeah, and I didn't really know him before, and it all came about through Twitter because I said one day, because someone had said like, oh, the numbers aren't amazing,
yeah,
but it's such a good show. And I think it's just people don't really know what the show is because it's called Terriers and there's a dog on the billboard and people probably think it's a dog show. And I was like, I want to do everything I can possible to try to help the show. And so Twitter gave me the ability and the podcast and the website gave me the ability to at least raise a little bit of awareness about the show. And like when I tweeted, does anyone from PR at FX follow me?
Right.
And literally 5 tweets later, someone's like, me.
Yeah.
And it all fell into place. And Donal came on, and he was a terrific guy.
I didn't put that together. I saw that tweet, and then I heard the podcast, but I didn't think
That was all me like hunting for it and seeing, you know, if I was just kind of dragging a net across Twitter and it worked, and you know, and. And he was great, and I felt really great about, you know, or like there was a or like sending out the thing about the little girl who got bullied because she has a Star Wars thermos at school. I mean, that of course inspired instant nerd rage on my behalf just for being completely tormented for very similar things when I was in grade school. So, you know, those parts of it are really really cool when, you know, you feel like I can help raise awareness for things that I find, you know, interesting.
We talked about, you know, Weird Al, and there's this throughout your career, there's this permeation of both comedy and music. Did you ever make a decision to focus on one or the other, or I must mesh them because they are both what I have to do, or?
Well, it was just, you know, I was sort of, when Furman and I met in college, and then we had performed together as Hard and Firm a couple times in college, and then we went our own separate ways work wise. And then many years later, right when Comedy Death Race popped up in Los Angeles, I brought Mike up to do one of the old songs that we did, and it was really fun. And we just started writing more and more stuff. And then at a certain point, he quit his job. He was working in digital effects for CSI Miami, and
I had to make a bunch of cum stories today. Did he come back with?
Well, for Mike, he was a digital compositor, so they'd be like, we need a billboard in the background.
Oh, okay.
So he would composite in a billboard.
Not like
in the background.
A cum billboarder.
No. So he quit his job. He was working like 15 hours a day. He happily quit his job, and then we started doing more and more Hard Firm stuff, and then that just sort of took over for a few years.
Yeah. I mean, I. My first exposure to your post MTV dating show career was Rodeohead.
Oh yeah, which by the way was as much a tribute to Weird Al as it was to Radiohead. It was a tribute to the polka medleys.
See, to me that is one of those things that there's this inherent comedy in music if you're a musician that you can almost play a funny note, you know, and Rodeohead does that for me where you're singing serious songs, and you are singing them in a legitimate style of music that people do enjoy with well-played instruments, but it's hilarious because there's this underlying comedy to, I shouldn't be doing this way. It's I don't know. There's something about that that well before Twitter and well before the Nerdist kept you on my radar as far as I need to know what these guys are doing because it's funnier just to play a song in the wrong style of music than
well,
it is to parody.
Especially if it's like a silly, upbeat, you know.
Yeah.
Style. I mean, that's what's always so great about
the
polka
medleys.
That's
on my phone right now. And if it comes on in the car, I'm jamming along the whole way. So, I mean, that's did you ever do that live or was it possible to do it
live?
Yeah,
we did it live. We put together a band and it was almost impossible to find a banjo player. The banjo in the song Rodeohead, Furman assembled it in a program in software. He assembled it note for note for note for note, and then we applied a banjo sample to it. So it's actually a sampled banjo playing, you know, a string of music that was assembled by hand. Yes.
Wow.
And so all the other instruments are real, except for the banjo Radiohead. So it was very hard to find. Like, we reached out to banjo clubs in L.A., and all the banjo players know each other. So they're like, no.
Eight of them.
You need this guy who plays a four-string banjo, and he can play. Because, you know, the thing with Radiohead is that there are time signature changes and tempo changes, and it doesn't lend itself to banjo playing very well.
Have you ever seen their like HDNet special? It's basically them in a studio, HD cameras everywhere, and they just play through like 12 songs.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was possible. I've never seen them live.
And they're amazing live. They're so good live. They're a good fucking band live. Like, they're just a really solid. I've seen them live.
There's a lot of times where you're like, well, that's not, there's no way to do that with real drums. And you're just watching it happen.
And they do it. And so we found this one guy. We finally found this one guy named Cody Bryant who could play it, and he was really good. And so, you know, we assembled this band, and we had this Asian guy who was a classical violinist playing bluegrass music with a 350-year-old violin playing fiddle. And we did, and it just started to get expensive.
Right.
Like, well, now we're paying these guys every time to perform. And
were you playing just the mashup, or were you playing individual songs?
Nope, just the mashup.
Wow, it's a lot for one song.
It is. And so then we realized we couldn't sustain that, and so we had this idea to shoot them all playing in a studio. And because there's a video element to our show, and so we made a video and made it look like they were piped in live via satellite. Like, we put a scrolling news ticker at the bottom, and made it look like, you know, that it was all a satellite thing. And the funny thing was, people would come up after the shows and they'd be like, "How did you hook up a satellite thing?" And we're like, "You didn't see the part at the bottom that said sharks are assholes?"
Right.
Like
that's
what,
not on CNN.
What news thing did you think this was? But what we realized was that most people don't want to sit through and listen to Radiohead. You can ask any group of people, for the most part, like, who likes Radiohead, and a majority of them will cheer. But then when you get into the deep cuts of Radiohead, but it's the deep cuts. Like, there's like 17 or 18 songs in there on Radiohead, and layered in such a way that, you know, like, the bass line of one song is under the melody of another song.
See, to me, that's actually when I start to laugh, is when I realize those things. Being a musician, that's what I find an extra layer of comedy there, where it's like, I see what you're doing, jerks. I see what's going on here.
Yep. You know? But most people on a live show did not want to sit through that, and so it just put people to sleep, so we stopped doing it.
Speaking of doing material for potentially the wrong audience, I've seen you in what may be the geekiest venue there is, which was Woodstock San Diego.
Oh, yeah, what a great show that was.
Amazing. And then I see you here in Dallas, Texas.
Yep.
Do you feel like you have to pull back the nerd a bit for
Dallas? Yeah, a little bit.
Or?
Although more nerds are coming out to the shows. I mean, you came to the 6:30 show, and the 6:30 show, like, you could see there were a couple of what we call white hairs in the audience.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an early show on a Saturday night. So, I mean, I can get a gauge pretty quickly, like, what the nerd constituency is.
Right.
And, you know, the higher it is, then the more into the nerd jokes I will get.
Has any place surprised you where you got big reactions to nerd stuff, and then you could throw out more and more and more where you weren't expecting it?
Oh, I mean, I think I'm always a little surprised, especially when I get into the South. You know, I don't know why that is. I don't know, because if I'm in a city like Seattle or Portland, I mean, cities like that are nerd magnets.
Yeah.
You know, and of course there are nerds everywhere in the country. It's just they're, you know, sometimes it's harder to cluster them together.
Are you more comfortable in that crowd?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, there's so, like, even the Woodstock that we did in L.A. pretty recently, Will wasn't there, and so I sat in for him. I mean, it's, you know, when you can make impulse power jokes, and it's not necessarily the style of comedy is any different. It's just that the bank of references, it's sort of like a MIDI bank on a keyboard. Like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to go to this kit because that's what will be appropriate for these people. And I try to force some of the nerd stuff on the non-nerd crowds, but, you know, it's just, they just don't connect with it as well, and there's really no benefit for me trying to make them sit through stuff that they don't understand. So
I have the same problem when I do. The cool thing about comics online is that if someone doesn't like it, they don't have to read it, and it's one person to one person to one person.
Sure.
There's no audience you have to please.
Yeah.
Individuals spread out across the world. But I find myself like making too deep of a TNG reference, mm-hmm. like way too. No, not everybody saw the Nanites episode.
No.
I don't know if I can do this, but then I do it anyway. But I try and throw a little bit broader joke, at least in the same panel or in the same area. And whenever the people are like, I saw the super deep TNG reference, I'm like, you're my people. These are the people that are going to support me forever.
Well, ultimately, if you, you know, well, early on, Patton Oswalt said, like, told me, you know, I like to do one joke for me and one joke for the audience.
Right.
I mean, now people go out to see him specifically, so it's different. But, you know, like a year and a half ago, I would notice there were a handful of nerds and then a lot of rednecks. And so I would just kind of pong back and forth between right. like nerd joke, redneck joke, nerd joke, redneck joke. And
do you find yourself adjusting the set throughout based on reaction? Or?
Well, yeah, I mean, because I talk to the crowd a lot usually, and so it will vary based on that. I think that if you really were really committed to it and you had a really long-term plan, you could just make the nerdiest jokes you wanted,
right.
lose most of the audience, but the nerds who were there will be much more loyal because you're really speaking to them. And then the second or third time you come back around, you'll start to see, you know, a shift in the people who are coming
out
to your
shows.
They
brought their friends out. And
I mean, the only reason that I try not to alienate people in my shows is because I like it. I mean, it's fun when people have fun at the show. So, you know, I try to include everyone.
Just a couple more and we'll wrap
sure.
it up. What do you feel you mentioned at the show tonight, you know, D&D Latin club, which
yeah.
me too,
Catholic school Latin.
Oh yeah. Mine was an elective. So I guess I made a mistake, but, I went to public school. Latin's weird.
Well, Latin wasn't elective. Some people took Spanish or French, but I had this idea like, well, you know, Latin is the base of, you know, the Romance languages. So
a bunch of my buddies signed, it was seventh grade that you had to pick your, no, eighth grade, you had to pick your ninth grade electives. And so they're all like, we're all doing Latin. And I'm like, wow, that's, yeah, sign me up. You know, and it turned out it was because one of our friend's dads was the professor. So they all thought it was going to be super cool. It was super cool. He was an amazing teacher, but it's the hardest fucking thing there is. Like there was just nothing harder. It was like word math, you know?
Yeah, but it also, I mean, the thing that I liked about it is that when you learn your first language, you don't ever think of things in terms of structure. So Latin forces you where you're like, wait, subjunctive, what is that? And then yeah. you realize like, oh, we have subjunctive clauses in English.
Yeah.
You just didn't know that's what they were called. And so it's just sort of like once you sort of learn how language is structured, then I think it makes it a lot easier to then go learn other languages, you know, that have a similar base because you kind of get how it where it all came from and how it works.
I think Latin Club was the like melting pot of misfits. Like no one was there. The only people that were there for the right reason in my school were going, their plan was pre-med or something, like, you know, and
sure.
everybody else, we were just extreme weirdos. And it was a weird place for us to get together.
It's a pretty, I think it's a pretty gothy thing to do. I mean, it's a dead language.
Yeah.
So, I mean, although it's dead in the sense that people don't use Latin per se, but it's not dead in the sense that it's, you know,
essentially English.
It's the blood of most language yeah. that we would speak, you know, the Romance languages, or so. It's, I don't know.
We had a slogan useful. For our club was "I do as he does," which translated as "I go fuck it," and that was like nerds, like, you know, this is not even actually funny. But,
ours was. Is this ours? Ubi es sub ubi, where is your underwear?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We had that one.
So
there's only like three Latin jokes. So
I think they're pretty much it.
So among that and D&D and various other influences, when did you realize as a kid, I think as we all do, that maybe not I'm different, but my interests are different, or perhaps there is something unusual about my interests that not everybody is looking at things the same way I do?
I think I realized that around second or third grade. My parents moved. We moved a lot, and so I was never really around the same group of kids for a super long period of time. And I was always way into comedy, like comedy records and
right.
stand-up specials. And it just when other kids were talking about whatever they talked about, I don't know, sports or whatever else, and I would quote comedy specials and no one would know what I was talking about, I think I realized, like, oh, this might just be me.
I remember being in seventh or eighth grade, because we were still in middle school, and there was a dance, and all of my friends, all my nerd friends got together and were like, we're going to go to the dance, you know, and none of us had dates and none of us had any intention of dancing. And we ended up in one of the halls reciting state sketches for an hour and a half, you know, and I got really pissed because there was this new kid with like a photographic memory and he knew all of the state sketches word for word. You know, no issues. But I remember like that was maybe the only school dance I ever went to. So, you know, you start to look at everybody else and you're like, yeah, there's something different here. Like we're having a lot of fun, but it seems wrong too, that we're like maybe not supposed to be here.
Well, that's why it's always so interesting when I think a lot of comics have this experience when they ultimately, did the show start? Okay. You know, a comedy nerd in a small town. I mean, this is sort of why the internet's kind of changed everything, but pre-internet. And then you would go to a larger city and start doing comedy at open mics and hang around with other comics and then realize, I'm not so unique at all.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There are tons of people who make the same references and have the same, you know, speech rhythms and whatever. It's just I'd never met any of them in my town.
Yeah.
But, you know, they all ended up clumping together and, you know, at these open mics in these bigger cities. And then you kind of feel like, I'm a part of a thing.
We have two questions from Twitter, real quick ones, and then sure. We'll let you go because I know your next show is going to start here pretty quick. From @Jesse_Monster, whom would you most like to interview for the Nerdist podcast? And I'll add to that, have you already done that interview?
Well, I've gotten quite a few people that I really wanted. I've been pretty lucky with that so far. Al and Craig Ferguson I'm trying to get Joan Rivers on the podcast.
Yeah.
Because her
I heard that movie's amazing.
That Mike Birbiglia said it made him cry. It's so incredible. And so I want to get she apparently is just super OCD, you know, like as pure of a pure comic as you can possibly be, sort of a workhorse.
Right.
And I would love to talk to her. I thought maybe I wanted Steve Martin on, but then I figured that he probably, hey Chelsea, but then I realized that he doesn't really talk about himself. He's sort of a shy guy.
Right.
And so I kind of thought like, maybe that would be kind of forcing him to come on.
I know he's one of your heroes. Do you feel like that might be one of the ones best left alone because you want to keep whatever impression you have of him? Or
maybe so. Maybe. I mean, I met him once. It didn't go very well.
I hear that a lot.
He wasn't mean. He was just sort of I went into fan mode and then his eyes just kind of glazed over. But I really want Harold Ramis on.
Oh, wow.
I really want Harold Ramis on. He's one that I'm going to try for. I would love to get Hugh Laurie on and just talk about
him.
Stephen Fry.
Well, Hugh Laurie is best character actor on television right now. I think second, possibly tied with John Noble.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I could just stare into their eyes and listen to them speak.
I just had Matt Smith on, so that was kind of a big deal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'd love to get David Tennant on as well because, you know, like he was a fantastic doctor.
Very last question from @DKP Lewis. Are you happy with the way the Node beta testing is going? And what's your future for our favorite nerd sourcing site?
Oh, interesting. Yes, I'm very happy with it. There have been people are actually using it the way that we had wanted them to use it, which is people are collaborating, they're meeting, they're forming groups. They're, you know, just like
real world things are happening because of internet.
Yeah, they really are. But even just all the groups that are formed in there of, you know, board game nerds or Battlestar nerds or Borg nerds or whatever. It's just like people are actually communicating and creating content. And that's why I always wanted that site to be like a collaboration network. Where people who didn't know each other could meet other people and like, oh, you like that too? Let's make a thing. And then they make a thing.
Do you want that just to keep going and see what happens organically? Or do you have this vision?
Yeah, I mean, I have these visions and I don't know if they'll ever come true. But I have these, this is probably so stupid to say out loud. But I would love if, you know, if there was actually some sort of a major problem, like, this dam is going to burst unless we figure out how to... And then, you know, we just go to the engineer group in the node and be like, all right, guys, there's no government bureaucracy here, so how do we fix this problem? And they all come together and solve this major problem, you know, because of
transparent
their...
Transparent aluminum. And
yeah, exactly. They've transparent aluminum, right, exactly. Years before it's supposed to come out.
Hello, computer. I think that's really cool that you're sort of taking the internet has this negative stink to it, and I think when you tell people, nope, we're only going to do positive things, that's the only reason to be here. If you don't want to do that, don't do this, but this is a positive part of the internet. And then to watch people sort of regain that respect and
one troll can fuck up everything. Yeah. Like, one troll can just make it not worth it. Because then you're just like, I don't need to go on and see.
Do you find they police
shit
themselves, though? Do they?
Yeah, like if anyone sneaks onto the board and starts saying shitty things, someone will tell us if we don't already see it, and you know we'll give them a chance to, maybe they were having a bad day. We'll respond to them. Here's why this or this or this. But if they continue to be shitty, then we'll ban them, because I just don't. It's just not fucking worth it. Like, it's just not worth it, and that's not what it's supposed to be about. And they can fuck off and live their own
but
negative life
someplace
else.
But it sounds like you're getting out of it what you intended. So people are the feedback I hear from my readers and listeners is a lot of positivity and a lot of we are accomplishing things there, and I enjoy participating in this community. So it seems like for the most part you're accomplishing the goal, if there is one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like the fact that we keep it, I mean, I almost kind of want to keep it closed the way it is now, right, like invite only, but you know, sooner or later the node will have to generate some kind of income so that we can keep it going and actually pay people to make it better. Right now we're using the Ning network. It would be really great if we could develop our own platform that's a little looser, but Ning is great for our needs right now, and be able to customize the site a little more. So, I mean, that stuff just all takes money, and, you know,
yeah.
I don't know, I don't really know when we'll get to that point, but right now we're just sort of seeing how people work together and seeing if there is anything there, and I think there is so far.
That's very cool. Chris, I really appreciate you doing the podcast.
Thanks, Joel.
This will probably go up in middle of next week. Is there anything? I know you said you have a book coming out.
That's like a year away.
Okay, so in a year, re-listen to this podcast. There's a book.
Maybe the, you
any
know,
shows coming up next week sometime around the country?
No, I'm off. These shows in Addison are my last shows of the year.
Chris, I don't think you realize that I'm giving you a podium with 1,000 people.
Oh my gosh! So I better put a show together.
This is not an opportunity that you,
I did
you
love your comic,
have.
By the way. I was very flattered when I saw your comic that had me in it. I was like, "Holy shit! Someone, I made a comic." I mean, I loved comics when I was a kid. I loved panel comic, like short form panel comics. You know, it was huge, Foxtrot and huge Bloom County fan, like a rabid Bloom County fan.
For me, it was always Bill Watterson.
Calvin and Hobbes, of
course.
Probably
the only reason I started making comics.
Absolutely. Also a philosophy major, Bill Watterson.
And a curmudgeon. Yeah.
I'm not going to make any more Calvin and Hobbes. It's over.
The rumor that goes around now is that he paints watercolors and then destroys them.
That seems about right.
Which I think is kind of beautiful. I really appreciate you being on the show, Chris.
Thanks, man.
Who's coming up on Nerdist Podcast?
Matt Smith is coming up on Nerdist Podcast. Billy West was a super fun one.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, he was great. The Sklar Brothers are coming up. I think we'll probably do another Corolla podcast. We're going to do a comedy special because I loved stand-up comedy specials when I was a kid. Those are like those Dangerfield young comedian specials.
Right.
So we're going to do a special of like comics you should know, and it'll just be a stand-up special.
Very cool.
Recorded at Meltdown Comics.
All right. Well, thanks for being on Hijinks and Sue Podcast.
Thank you, Hijinks and Sue.
We're out of here. Modern life is much too hard with no jetpacks or